Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Eighth Amendment and Mandatory Juvenile Life Sentences Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 25, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Miller v. Alabama, linked with Jackson v. Hobbs. The question was whether a mandatory sentence of life in prison without possibility of parole, imposed for a murder committed when the defendant was 14 years old, constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth and Fourteenth Amendments. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kagan, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that the Eighth Amendment prohibits a sentence scheme that mandates life sentence in prison without possibility of parole for juvenile homicide offenders. Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor joined the majority opinion. Justice Breyer filed a concurring opinion, which was joined by Justice Sotomayor. Chief Justice Roberts filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. Justice Thomas and Justice Alito each filed separate dissenting opinions, both of which were joined by Justice Scalia. To discuss the case, we have John Stiniford, who is an assistant professor at the University of Florida Levin School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Stiniford.
Hi, I'm here today to talk about Miller versus Alabama, the Supreme Court's latest Eighth Amendment case discussing the meaning of the cruel and unusual punishments clause. And this case is an example of the Supreme Court's recent tendency toward reaching defensible results in Eighth Amendment cases for increasingly indefensible reasons. And I'll go through that in just a moment. One quick note on reading the opinion, in fact, all the opinions in Miller versus Alabama, they all seem sort of half-hearted, though the justices wore themselves out over the healthcare case and did not have much energy to expend on this one. Both the majority opinion and, to a large degree, the dissents are a little bit disappointing, but nonetheless, it's worth talking about what the court did here and why. The question presented in Miller versus Alabama was whether a mandatory sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for a person convicted of murder committed while he was a juvenile violates the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishments. Now, there are two different cases actually here, Miller versus Alabama and Jackson versus Hobbs, that got consolidated into one opinion. The defendants in both cases shared certain characteristics in common. They both grew up in an atmosphere of severe poverty and abuse. They both had a history of acting out to harm themselves or others. They both had problems with drug abuse. Each defendant committed the murder that resulted in a life sentence when he was 14 years old. The first defendant, Evan James Miller, committed the more horrific of the two murders. After a plan to steal a baseball card from the victim went bad, Miller attacked the victim with a baseball bat, beating him over the head until he could no longer get off the floor. Miller and his friend then stole $300 from the victim's wallet and set the victim's trailer on fire. The victim died in the fire, apparently of smoke inhalation. Contrell Jackson, on the other hand, the defendant in the second case, appears to have been convicted of murder based on a theory of conspiracy liability. Jackson and two friends attempted to rob a local video store. One of Jackson's friends apparently brought a shotgun with him. Jackson was supposed to act as a lookout, but did end up coming inside the store during the robbery. When the store clerk refused to give the boys any money and threatened to call the police, one of the boys shot the clerk in the face and killed her. Contrell Jackson was not the shooter, but because he was part of the conspiracy to rob the store, he was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole. Okay, so the question, again, in this case, both of these defendants were convicted under state statutes that called for a mandatory term of life imprisonment for commission of a murder. And the question in this case was whether those statutes that mandated such sentences were constitutional with respect to juvenile offenders. Now, just by way of background regarding the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, long ago, in fact, more than half a century ago now, the Supreme Court abandoned any effort to determine the original meaning of the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. It announced instead that it would focus on evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. And the basic question under this standard is there currently a societal consensus against a given punishment? If so, then the punishment is cruel and unusual. And if not, then the punishment's okay. And theoretically, this is supposed to let the court keep up with the times and make the Eighth Amendment's meaning change as societal standards change. But in fact, it has not proved to be a very useful standard for the court, in large part because any sentence or punishment that reaches the Supreme Court is one that will have been approved by at least one state legislature, very often many state legislatures, and imposed by at least one jury, and very often many juries. So if you have a legislature and a jury, or several of them, the punishment is mandated or justified, it's hard to argue that there's a societal consensus against that punishment. As a result, in recent years, the court has also emphasized its right to exercise its own, quote, independent judgment to determine whether a punishment is cruel and unusual. Now, the independent judgment prong of the court's analysis involves absolutely no constitutional standards whatsoever. It's basically the court using its own gut to decide whether a punishment is constitutional or not. Because the use of a standard like this involves a really breathtaking assertion of judicial authority, the court has been careful in prior cases to at least pretend that its decision also comported with current standards of decency. So, for example, it may strike down a punishment that's been approved by more than half of the legislatures in the country, but if it's rarely imposed, the court will say, in fact, juries don't impose this punishment, therefore there's a current societal standard against it, etc. So that's been the court's strategy up to this point. Now, in Miller versus Alabama, the court virtually abandons the evolving standards of decency test and decides the case almost completely based on its own subjective judgment. The court's analysis basically works as follows. The court starts by focusing on a couple of lines of its own prior cases dealing with the Eighth Amendment. First, there are several cases in which the court imposed a categorical ban on a certain kind of punishment based on the nature of the crime or the nature of the offender. In particular, in prior cases, it had held that the death penalty was unconstitutional for juvenile offenders and that sentences of life without parole were unconstitutional for juvenile non-homicide offenders. And it had based these decisions based on its own reading of current brain science regarding juveniles. And basically the court's conclusion that as a group, juveniles, that is those who are under the age of 18, have lesser culpability than adults and a greater possibility of rehabilitation than adults because their brain is still developing. So there are those prior cases. There's also a second line of prior cases that the court in Miller versus Alabama looks at. These are cases involving the procedures for imposing the death penalty. And in prior cases, the court has said that before the death penalty can be imposed in a given case, the jury must consider the characteristics of the offender and the details of the offense. That is, there can be no mandatory death penalty for any given crime. So taking these two strands of cases and mixing them together, the court in this case says, well, juveniles are less culpable as a group, they're more likely to rehabilitate as a group, and a sentence of life without parole is similar to the death penalty in that once you're put in prison, you never get out, you're going to die in prison. And so taking these two lines of cases and jumbling them together, the court reaches the conclusion that, in fact, it is unconstitutional to impose a mandatory life sentence without possibility of parole on a juvenile homicide offender. It is still at least theoretically possible to impose such a sentence on juvenile offenders, that is, a sentence of life without possibility of parole, but only if a jury finds that such a sentence is appropriate. Now, all of this part of the court's reasoning really follows under the prong of the court's independent judgment. That is, it's simply looking to its own prior determinations regarding juvenile brain science and regarding the procedures necessary for imposition of the death penalty and applying them in a new case. Up to this point, the court has not looked at all to current standards of decency. The court does briefly touch on these things, and it's really at this point in the opinion that the court's decision starts to appear patently ridiculous. Again, as I mentioned a minute ago, the primary indicia of current standards of decency that the court has relied on in the past are either legislative enactments or jury verdicts. Now, at the time Miller versus Alabama was decided, 29 states had statutes calling for mandatory sentences of life without possibility of parole for at least some juvenile murderers. So a fairly substantial majority of states approved or indeed mandated such sentences. Also, at the time the case was decided, there were over 2,000 offenders currently in prison serving such a sentence. This is a much larger number of offenders than in prior cases where the court found a societal consensus against the punishment. So you have a large number of states that approve the punishment, apparently a large number of juries that are imposing the punishment, and yet the court says that it believes that, in fact, there is a societal consensus against the punishment. The court's basic reasoning is as follows. The reason juveniles were sentenced under these statutes is because of a set of state statutes allowing for prosecution as adults for certain kinds of crimes. And the court concluded that when it authorized those statutes, the state legislatures did not consider the fact that this would mean that juvenile offenders would, in many cases, be given mandatory life sentences for committing murder. And so the court basically says that the legislation authorizing such punishments was enacted inadvertently and thus is not a good indicator of current standards of decency. The court also points out that since the sentences were mandatory for the commission of a crime, there's no jury determination that the punishment was deserved. And so because the legislative enactments were considered to be a sort of accident by the court, it held there was no evidence of a societal consensus in favor of the punishment. Of course, even if the court were correct here, and I think its reasoning is quite open to question, the fact that there isn't proof of a societal consensus in favor of the punishment does not mean that there's any proof of a societal consensus against the punishment, which is what the standard is supposed to be. In fact, to the extent we know anything about societal attitudes, they seem to be more in favor of this punishment than against this punishment. But nonetheless, that's the decision in the case. The court says that because its own prior cases contain reasoning about juvenile responsibility and about the procedures for the death penalty, now certain procedures have to be followed in cases involving juvenile murderers. Specifically, the jury has to be required to take into account the nature of the offender and the nature of the offense before imposing a sentence of life without possibility of parole. This case may well be a precursor to future cases in which the court actually forbids such punishments for juvenile offenders altogether. We'll just have to wait and see on that. Now, one last point, and that is, at the beginning of this talk, I said that the result in Miller versus Alabama was defensible even though the reasoning was not. And I want to talk about that for just one moment. Really, no one in this case talks at all about the original meaning of the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. But in fact, the word unusual in the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause does not mean rare or uncommon. It means new. It means contrary to long usage. The Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause is designed to prevent punishments that are cruel and new, that is, cruel in light of longstanding practice. And in fact, one could make a good argument that the imposition of mandatory sentences of life without parole on juvenile offenders is in fact cruel in light of long practice. For at least a century prior to the 1990s, most juvenile offenders were treated not as adults in criminal cases, but rather within a separate juvenile system, focusing primarily on rehabilitation rather than punishment. Individual cases could be moved into the adult system, but there had to be a determination by a judge that such a move was appropriate in light of the characteristics of the offender and the nature of the offense. Again, notice the same language that we're seeing here in the court's current opinion. That started to change in the 1990s when there was a public scare about super predators, where the public became convinced that juvenile offenders were going to break into everyone's home and cut their throat during the night, and we needed to do something to stop them. And in the face of this public panic, legislatures acted in order to make it much easier to prosecute juveniles as adults, and particularly to impose very long sentences on juvenile murderers and other violent offenders. Now, to the extent that this change is the result of a public panic, it's precisely the sort of thing the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause was meant to prevent. The whole idea behind it was that sometimes there's a public scare that results in the imposition of unduly harsh punishments, either because the legislatures have authorized them or because judges or juries have started imposing them due to a kind of irrational panic or hatred towards a group of offenders. Again, one could argue that that's the case with this sort of sentence towards juvenile offenders. So had the court used the proper mode of reasoning, its ultimate decision that the imposition of a mandatory sentence of life without possibility of parole on juvenile murderers might be quite defensible. But again, instead, the court chose to rely only on its own judgment with no constitutional standards to guide it. And so this case is, although the result, I think, is not a bad one, the reasoning is another example of pure imposition of judicial will.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.